We are actuaries. In a world filled with unpredictability, we use our math skills to navigate uncertainty. Actuaries make a difference in people's lives across industries and the world. Actuaries have the freedom to work anywhere. And according to U.S. News & World Report, we're the 25th top-paying career. Make an impact as a fact seeker and a truth teller. Use your math skills for good as an actuary. The world needs you.
How would you like a 15% discount to my daily email, the stack of stuff, the show notes, discounts to the conference, all of that? All you need to do is text the word show to 33777. You'll get the annual subscription with a 15% discount to my daily email. You'll get the stack of stuff, the links to the show notes, discounts to the conference, and so much more. All you have to do is text the word show, S-H-O-W, to 33777. Text show to 33777.
Welcome to the Eric Erickson Show podcast, Hour 3.
Greetings, welcome. It is Eric Erickson here across the nation. The phone number, 877-973-7425, is the number. If you want to be on the program, we've got now some of the audio that trickled in from the Supreme Court hearing on Trump earlier today. I want to just play some of this. This is an exchange with the lawyer, Mr. Sauer, who is Trump's lawyer, and Justice Sotomayor.
Can be alleged, but it has to be proven. Malum in se is a concept long viewed as appropriate in law, that there's some things that are so fundamentally evil that they have to be protected against. Now, I think, answer below, I'm going to give you a chance to say if you stay by it. If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he's can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could, and why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing them, doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility? He's doing it for personal gain.
I agree with that characterization of the indictment, and that confirms immunity, because the characterization is that there's a series of official acts that were done for an unlawful
purpose. No, because immunity says even if you did it for personal gain, we won't hold you responsible. How could that be?
That's an extremely strong doctrine in this court's case law in cases like Fitzgerald.
Well, we go back to Justice Thomas's question, which.
Yeah, look, I don't think he did himself favors on that exchange today. Here's a little more from the case. This is Justice Alito, and he is talking to Michael Dreeben, who is the counselor for the special counsel. He's the lawyer for Jack Smith.
It is correct, Justice Alito, but I think that we should also consider the history of this country. As members of the court have observed, it's baked into the Constitution that any president knows that they are exposed to potential criminal prosecution. My friend says after impeachment and conviction, we don't read the impeachment judgment clause that way, but it's common ground that all former presidents have known that they could be indicted and convicted. And Watergate cemented that understanding. The Watergate smoking gun tape involved President Nixon and H.R. Haldeman talking about and then deciding to use the CIA to give a bogus story to the FBI to shut down a criminal investigation.
I mean, Mr. Sauer and others have identified events in the past where presidents have engaged in conduct that might have been charged as a federal crime, and you say, well, no, that's not really true. This is page 42 of your brief. So what about President Franklin D. Roosevelt's decision to intern Japanese Americans during World War II. Couldn't that have been charged under 18 U.S.C. 241, conspiracy against civil rights?
Today, yes, given this court's decision in Trump versus United States, in which Trump versus Hawaii, excuse me, where the court said Korematsu was overruled. I mean, President Roosevelt made that decision with the advice of his attorney general. That's a layer of
safeguard. Is that really true? I thought Attorney General Biddle thought that there was really no threat of sabotage, as did J. Edgar Hoover.
So I think that there is a lot of historical controversy, but it underscores that that occurred during wartime. It implicates a potential commander-in-chief concerns about the exigencies of national defense that might provide an as-applied Article II challenge at the time. I'm not suggesting today, but the idea that a decision that was made and ultimately endorsed by this court, perhaps wrongly, in the Korematsu case, would support criminal prosecution under 241, which requires under United States versus Lanier that the right have been made specific so that there is notice to the president, I don't think that would have been satisfied.
All right. Well, we could go through other history.
Okay. Just one last clip, just so you guys have a sense of the arguments in the court. So this, again, this is Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Brown Jackson, with John Sauer, who was Donald Trump's lawyer before the court today.
Benjamin Franklin said, as we view the prosecution of a chief executive as something that everybody cried out against as unconstitutional. And what George Washington said is, we're worried about factional strife, which will...
No, I'm also, let me put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? It's right now the fact that we're having this debate because OLC has said that presidents might be prosecuted. Presidents from the beginning of time have understood that that's a possibility. That might be what has kept this office from turning into the kind of crime center that I'm envisioning. But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want, I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
I respectfully disagree with that because the regime you've described is the regime we've operated under for 234 years. There has not been an expectation based on 234 years of unbroken political...
All right, let me ask you another question.
So my point in playing this for you is a couple of things. One, the justice system is working. The judges, all of them, the justices are asking probative questions of both sides. They're pushing both sides. They're trying to find a way to move forward. What I think is the case in having played you these excerpts, they were the ones that kind of caught my eye, but they also caught the eye of plenty of other people. And there is a growing consensus here that the Supreme Court is going to alter the Court of Appeals decision from the District of Columbia. It's very clear that John Roberts in particular really did not like the decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals and thought it was way too broadly written. But I also think they're not going to give Trump what he wants. They broadly seem willing to reject the argument that Donald Trump made. What I find notable is the conservative justices, including those who Trump appointed, were completely unreceptive to the idea that Donald Trump gets some level of immunity that protects him from prosecution. But the conservative justices on the court are also deeply concerned about the lawfare angle. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh both said we're headed into territory where any president who leaves office is going to have to pardon himself because prosecutors are going to come after him. The weaponization of the prosecutors to prosecute court. I think it's a concern. I think it's valid. Devlin Barrett and Ann Miramau, who are observers of the Supreme Court for The Washington Post, kind of corroborate where I am in this. One, the justices seem to generally agree that Trump does not have blanket immunity. There is no perfect system, Assistant Special Counsel Michael Dreeben told the high court as he argued for them to allow the prosecution of Trump. Dreeben told the justices the current legal system works pretty well. It may need some fine-tuning in the form of whatever ruling the court makes, but not the radical proposal offered by Trump's lawyer that Trump and all presidents operate with broad protection. Amy Coney Barrett replied, "I agree." Chief Justice Roberts slammed the sweeping decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit that denied Trump's immunity claim. If the majority of the nine-justice panel agrees with him, that could push Trump's trial well past the election. Roberts characterized the February decision reached by the appellate court as saying, in essence, that a former president can be prosecuted just because he's being prosecuted, and called it circular reasoning that, quote unquote, concerns me. The Chief Justice floated a proposal that would make the entire issue more complicated and time consuming rather than less. Now you know how easy it is in many cases for a prosecutor to get a grand jury to bring an indictment, Robert said. Why shouldn't we either send it back to the Court of Appeals or issue an opinion making clear that's not the law? If the Supreme Court sent back the issue of presidential immunity, it would drag out the case. The Supreme Court ruling is considered hugely important to Trump's legal and political chances, but conservative justices kept insisting they're more worried about the future. Brett Kavanaugh said their ruling will have huge implications, saying, I'm not as concerned about the here and now, I'm concerned about the future. It's not going to stop. It's going to cycle back, and it's used against the current president and the next president and the next president after that. Prosecutors investigating presidents is growing. The three liberal justices were focused on the future implications of the immunity ruling, but worried about granting Trump protection could subvert the very premise of the founding and give the president the tyranny of kings. Quote, the framers did not put an immunity clause in the Constitution. They knew how to. They were reacting against a monarch who claimed to be above the law. Wasn't the whole point that the president was not supposed to be above the law? John Sauer said the Constitution had checks on the presidency and did not describe a format for criminal prosecution of the president. While the conservatives fretted the ruling against Trump would create a permanently hobbled presidency, the liberals fretted that giving him significant immunity would encourage a new kind of criminal presidency without consequence. I think that fairly summarizes everything, and I think it gets to a larger issue. None of the justices on the court were in support of Trump's position, but they were divided over what to proceed because of the precedent setting for future cases. Here's what you need to know about arguments before the Supreme Court. When lawyers go before the Supreme Court, one of the things the justices look for is for the lawyers to conjure a generally applicable rule. They don't like to do it themselves. They want the lawyers to propose it. So they want the lawyers to come up with a rule that the justices can say, in cases moving forward, here's the rule you must follow. If this, then that. If not this, then that. They didn't get that from either side. Trump's lawyers were really not helpful, because Trump's lawyer's argument was a president can do whatever he wants until he's impeached. And then if he's impeached, he can be prosecuted on the basis of that impeachment. Otherwise, he can't be prosecuted. None of the justices bought that argument. Dreeben, who was the lawyer for Jack Smith's, his argument was, in this case, Trump can be prosecuted because he was indicted for things that were personal. So I think where the justices are going to hedge, based on what I heard, is they're going to conjure a rule that essentially says presidents can be prosecuted, even without impeachment, for criminally liable conduct based on personal gain and benefit. They can't be prosecuted based on anything that is plausibly a presidential action, but if it can be shown that they personally benefited from the action, then they can be prosecuted. I think they're going to head that way, because all of the justices did have legitimate concerns about future lawfare, future prosecutions of presidents, that every time a president leaves, he's going to have to give himself blanket immunity. Where the lawyers on both sides failed was to try to offer a rule that fit the case that was not broad. To their credit, Sauer and Dreeben on the other side both largely centered around a court of appeals decision, a D.C. court of appeals decision that kind of said presidents can be prosecuted if they personally benefit, but they can't be prosecuted for anything that is plausibly within presidential power. And I think the Supreme Court is going to head that way. But neither lawyer did a good job of articulating a rule. The court's going to have to come up with it themselves. But the bottom line here is Trump loses the case overall. Where he does win out, however, is it drags out the clock to the election. And if he becomes president, the case goes on pause, and he'll be fine with that. Hello there. Welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. Delighted to have you with me. The phone number, 877-973-7425. Be patient on the phones. I'll get to you when we come back. Real quick, though, I got to tell you, there's a story out. Have you heard about the flooding in Dubai? This is from the AP, and you got to listen to this paragraph real carefully. Circumstantial evidence points to climate change worsening the deadly deluge that just flooded Dubai and other parts of the Persian Gulf. But scientists didn't discover the definitive fingerprints of greenhouse gas-triggered warming they've seen in other extreme weather events, a new report found. This report, a rapidly done report, concluded that that Dubai experienced way more rainfall than it would have, but for climate change, and yet they could find no clear fingerprint. Quote, it's not such a clear fingerprint, but we have lots of circumstantial evidence, other lines of evidence that tell us we've seen this increase. Okay, so if you haven't seen pictures out of Dubai, it flooded. The place flooded. I mean, water up to the sides of cars, to the door handles of cars. Here's the thing. Charlie, Philip, so I grew up in Dubai. correct, so there's a story there anyway. But I lived over there in the 80s, and there would be occasional rainstorms. It happened once when I was a kid over there in the mid-80s. Same thing happened. Well before anybody was worried about climate change and the like, massive flood. We got out of school for days because the school flooded. Because it's a desert, and there's nowhere for the water really to run off. And it backed up the sewers. It was a mess. I mean, it was crazy that the rain was so high. Now, as a kid, it was up to my knees. It wouldn't be that high now. But in some parts of the city, it was even higher. Because of the way it flowed, this is not an unusual event. They're acting like this is an event that's never happened in Dubai before. When I was a kid, it happened. I was there. I lived through it. I got out of school for 3 days because the place flooded. This is not some wild thing. Yeah, it's rare, but it happens. You know, we're seeing things happen in the world today that make people a little bit skittish about what's going on in the economy. Banks are teetering on the verge of collapse. We now have this new economic data that the economy is slowing down. It would be negative but for government spending. That's why Swiss America wants to help you protect your hard-earned assets now. Swiss America has a report for you to read. It is completely free on the secret war on cash. You can get it by calling or texting my name to 800-289-2646. That's 800-289-2646. The all-out war on cash includes digital forms of currency, and it's spreading. You can read The Secret War on Cash for free to my listeners. All you do is mention my name, Eric Erickson, when you call or text 800-289-2646. That's it. Completely free. You just mention my name, Eric Erickson. You can text my name or call and talk to someone. Say Eric Erickson. 800-289-2646. Completely free. 800-289-2646. Message and data rates may apply. Greetings, conversationalists. Glad to have you back with me. 877-973-7425 is the phone number. We got to talk about the warning signs that people in the Biden administration are starting to think he's going to lose. Before I get to that, though, I want to take Jim's phone call. I've been waiting patiently. Jim, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great.
Well, you said that President Trump must have supported the Ukraine aid because of information he's getting. And today's Wall Street Journal front page says U.S. boosts capability missiles with new aid to Kyiv. It turns out we had secretly sent them a longer range missile than we had mentioned before, and they used it. on Russians. And then deeper in the article, they said one of the problems they're having in Ukraine is Russia's turning to North Korea for missiles, and they're attacking Ukraine infrastructure. Could that be part of the information that the, President Trump might be getting?
Oh, I definitely think so. In particular, Ukraine's backup strategy against the Russians. So let me say a couple things here. So here's some of the propaganda people have heard, because I've got it from callers. You're hearing that, for example, we're using up our stockpile of arsenal, sending it to Ukraine. That we're running out of ammo for ourselves because of going to Ukraine. Turns out that's not true. What we're doing is we're building new stuff and sending the old stuff to Ukraine. And we've now, with the supply chain issues resolved, are catching back up. The second thing is, yes, we sent Kyiv long-range missiles that could be used to target Russian infrastructure as the Russians are targeting Ukrainian infrastructure. And what we have found by sending Ukraine, and this is old technology, it's not current technology, that Ukraine, using our old technology, is able to bypass the bleeding-edge Russian air defense systems. That's an important revelation, because we had presumed the Russians had caught up to our Patriot missile batteries, and it turns out they have not. And we wouldn't know that but for sending Ukraine our outdated technology that can still bypass the air defense systems. Now, the other issue is the Russians are using North Korean and Iranian technology, and it's the bleeding edge technology from North Korea and Iran developed using Chinese components. By us sending arms to Ukraine, we're finding out in Ukraine whether or not our current technology can keep up with the bleeding edge in, from North Korea and Iran, which is very important, particularly as we look towards China moving in on Taiwan. We need to know, is the stuff that we've given Taiwan going to hold up? And guess what we're finding out? It is. Now, I got an email the other day from a guy who was very upset with me for saying I would rather us use our tech to kill Russians, let Ukraine kill Russians, than have our boys have to kill the Russians if the Russians invade a NATO ally. And he's very upset. This is morbid. This is disgusting. I can't believe you'd say that. No, I stand by it. Ukraine is in a war for its survival against Russia. If the Russians take Ukraine, they're going to move into Moldova. They're going to start harassing NATO countries. So this is a live fire exercise for us to see if our technology that we have right now that we're giving to allies can stop the Russians. And we're finding out, yes. Not only that, the Russians have started using the North Korean and Iranian latest technology. And the latest technology for North Korea and Iran is based on Chinese components. And our current technology, not the stuff, this is really important that you understand the flow of stuff here. We're sending our current technology to Ukraine, and we're developing what they're calling fifth and sixth generation technologies. So we're sending Ukraine our fourth generation technology and building fifth generation technology to replace it, and we're sending Ukraine fifth generation technology in other areas and building sixth generation technology. We're building the next generation of weapon systems, and we're giving Ukraine all of our current stuff. So Ukraine has our cutting-edge stuff, and we're replacing it with stuff that's even more bleeding-edge. And what we're finding is that our cutting-edge technology surpasses the Russian, the North Korean, the Chinese, and the Iranian technology. The only reason we know it is because we have a live-fire exercise in Ukraine where they're using it. Everything would be hypothetical. Everything would be hypothetical. And here's one of the hypotheticals that we know for certain, and it's been documented. One of the hypotheticals is that the Russians, Chinese, North Koreans, the Iranians had been able to come up with air defense technology that surpassed our current missile technology. We've sent Ukraine our current long-range missile technology. Ukraine has fired it into Russian infrastructure for oil refinery and oil production that was protected by the Russian, Chinese, North Korean, Iranian bleeding edge air defense systems. And our current systems bypassed it. The Ukrainians were able to blow up their targets. Not only were they able to blow up their targets, they were able to blow up their targets with great accuracy, despite not having proficient GPS. So not only can our missiles get through the bleeding-edge air defense systems, but our missiles can get through using mediocre fallback GPS systems. This is a live-fire exercise for the future against the Eastern Axis. And the surplus goods we're sending Ukraine still hold up well. It's one of the significant reasons it's worth supporting Ukraine, because we're headed down a dangerous path. And if we can show the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the Iranians that our current tech is better than their bleeding-edge tech, it slows down what they want to do while they try to catch up to our current technology. And while they're slowed down trying to catch up to our current technology, we're exceeding and surpassing our current technology, making it even harder for them to catch up. That's why it's been so important to do this, among other issues. Now, I want to pivot to a domestic issue. To do so, I need to read for you a piece from David Brooks, because I am intrigued by his column. Let me read you the start of this from David Brooks. Came out yesterday in the New York Times. Last fall, I argued that Joe Biden was the Democratic Party's strongest 2024 presidential nominee. I believed that for two reasons. One, he's been an effective president, and two, he's the Democrat most likely to appeal to working class voters. I still believe Biden is the party's strongest candidate, but I'm getting more pessimistic about his chances of winning. The first reason is not political rocket science. Voters prefer the Republicans on key issues like inflation and immigration. Most Donald Trump supporters I know aren't swept up in his cult of personality. They vote for him because they are conservative types who like GOP policies and think Trump is a more effective executive than Biden. The second reason I've become more pessimistic is because of what's happening to the youth vote. NBC News released an interesting poll last weekend finding that interest in this election is lower than in any other presidential election in nearly 20 years. Only 64% of Americans said they have a high degree of interest in the election, compared to, say, 77% who had high interest in 2020. But what really leaps out is the numbers for voters aged 18 to 34. Only 36% are highly interested. I imagine that's partly because it's difficult to get enthusiastic about candidates who are a half century older than you. But part of it is Biden's approach to the Israel-Hamas war. Young people are more critical of Israel. I think what we're seeing at Columbia and other elite campuses is a precursor to what we're going to see at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. In 1968, the clashes between the New Left activists and Mayor Daley's cops was an early marker of the differences between the more educated and less educated classes. They were part of a trend that sent the working class voters to the GOP. If there are similar clashes in Chicago this August, the chaos will reinforce Trump's core law and order message. It will make Biden look weak and hapless. Phrases like "from river to sea" will be the 2024's version of "defund the police," a slogan that appeals to activists and alienates other voters. I think David Brooks is right. By the way, there's some breaking news. Do you know the dock that we're building in Gaza? We're building a big pier. The American Navy and the Marines are building a big pier to get relief supplies into Gaza. The terrorists began attacking it with a mortar attack today. That's right. The Hamas brigades are attacking the pier that the Americans are building to send relief to Gaza. Well done. Well played, Joe Biden. But now there are two stories I want to call your attention to, and they are separate stories. They're unrelated, except through the regulatory acts. This is the Wall Street Journal. The Biden administration on Thursday issued sweeping new rules that crack down on power plant pollution and could force many of the country's coal plants to shutter unless they undertake costly upgrades. The rules, which will almost certainly be challenged in court, mandate strict controls on carbon dioxide emissions at existing coal plants and newly built natural gas plants. They set the stage for a significant infrastructure build-out to capture and dispose of CO2 emitted at such plants in order to comply. The changes come as the industry juggles the first upswing in power demand in two decades and a shifting generation mix. Solar and wind projects are being added to the grid, and utilities say more gas-fired power plants are needed for reliable replacement of coal. Some utilities say they could need aging coal plants to stay online longer than expected. Existing gas plants, the backbone of the nation's power supply, aren't included in the new rules. The electricity industry is central to America's economic growth and competitiveness. These are the folks who keep the lights on and power the country forward, says Michael Regan, the U.S. EPA administrator. At the same time, the power sector is a major contributor to pollution that drives climate. The new rules could cause blackouts as gas and coal plants aren't able to keep up with demand. There's another one also from the Wall Street Journal. Top business groups and a national tax services firm filed lawsuits Wednesday challenging a new Federal Trade Commission ban on non-compete agreements, cases that will test the agency's power to broadly prohibit practices it says are anti-competitive. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce challenged the regulation in federal court in East Texas, while the tax firm Ryan LLC filed its lawsuit in Dallas federal court. Other business groups joined the chamber suit. The rule issued by the FTC prohibits companies from enforcing existing non-compete agreements on anyone other than senior executives. I have a non-compete agreement. If I leave my radio station in Atlanta, Georgia, I can't be on another Atlanta station for 6 months. It's standard. When I was at CNN, I had a non-compete agreement that I couldn't be on another network for 6 months unless that network made an offer and CNN couldn't match it, and then I could hop. I've had non-compete agreements in my life. The FTC says they're unenforceable now. The EPA, the FTC, and now the FCC doing a net neutrality rule, they're rushing. They're rushing to get these rules out. They're rushing to upend the landscape. The Energy Department is rushing new rules into place on washers and dryers and water heaters and TVs and refrigerators. This is a sign of an administration that doesn't think it's going to be in power much longer. They're rushing the rules process. These aren't things they've been talking about for a while. They've sprung them on the American public and they've rushed them out the door. They've curtailed the amount of time for input from the public. They're trying to get them in place. Now, they wouldn't be rushing like this if they thought Joe Biden was going to win a second term. They would take their time. The reason the rushing is dangerous is because the rushing gives the federal courts an opportunity to say, nah, you rushed the process. Sorry. You got to walk it back and give more public input. They're taking a chance in doing this. And they're taking the chance because they don't think they're going to be around much longer. Again, it's a behavioral thing. They would not be rushing if they thought Joe Biden had another 4 years. They'd be following the processes. They'd be giving the public input its due. They'd be reviewing the public input. They'd be taking their time. That they're rushing is an indicator David Brooks is right. There's a growing pessimism within the administration about Biden's chances in November. That doesn't mean he's going to lose. He can still win. The odds are ever in the favor of an incumbent to win re-election. He's got more money than Trump. He can build a better ground game than Trump. His voters are more reliable at turning out than Trump's. There are lots of things to tell you Joe Biden's going to win in November. But when his administration does stuff like this, you can tell there's a lack of confidence. It's a problem. Americans for Prosperity is one of the groups, by the way, challenging some of these rules. Americans for Prosperity stands up for conservative values and conservative ideas around the country. They want you on their side. You can go to AmericansForProsperity.org/Eric today and sign up to be a part of Americans for Prosperity. They teach conservatives how to be better activists. They teach you how to go door to door, make persuasive cases to your neighbors. You know, so much of the left and the right now are just yelling at each other. They've lost the art of persuasion. Americans for Prosperity believes in the art of persuasion, and they've been highly effective at it, at getting school choice passed, at getting regulatory reform passed that helps small businesses and families. They're pro-family. They're pro-freedom. They're pro-consumer. You can sign up now at AmericansForProsperity.org/Eric. Sign up with AFP, become a very effective conservative activist, and roll back the big government, support limited government. Hello there. Welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. The phone number, well, tough. You're almost out of time, so never mind. All right. I still got this will help me fill in tomorrow because I got all sorts of stuff to talk about, including 42% of Democrats. Do you know what 42% of Democrats support? Mass deportation of illegal aliens. That's right. This is the Harris poll has come out. 42% of Democrats, 46% of independents, 68% of Republicans support mass deportations of illegal aliens. What I find so interesting is that 45% of Latinos do and only 40% of blacks do. So more Hispanics support deportation of illegal immigrants from the South than black people do, which is fascinating. 51% generally do. Now, what's so interesting is you move to the likely voter model and all the numbers go up. All the numbers go up. There is not a love for the illegal immigration happening in this country. And it's going to be hell to pay for Joe Biden. When you look at this sort of stuff out there, when you look at this data, the number one issue in America right now is not inflation in the economy. The number one issue in America right now is immigration. The number one issue. Number two is the economy slash inflation. When the number one and the number two issue are issues that play to Donald Trump's hand, and by the way, the three, four, and five issue do, crime is another issue, they all play into Donald Trump's hand, that's a big warning sign for the Democrats. Now, I'm a broken record on this, I realize, but the thing Republicans have to keep in mind is the voters most likely to vote don't like Donald Trump. White, high-income earners who are college-educated are more likely to vote than any other class of people in this country and have been for a very long time. It is why Donald Trump and his team have got to do an early voting project. They've got to get people out to vote. They've got to get people to early vote and absentee vote. They've got to get people to try to put some trust in the system to get their votes counted. Because if it's election day, they're going to lose. Because a lot of well-meaning people show up on election day, and when it starts raining, they leave the line. Or when it's snowing, they leave the line. When the line is too long and they got stuff to do and they're tired after work, they leave the line. You got to bank those votes early, people. Start getting your absentee ballots in when you can for your general election for November. You got to vote early. Vote absentee. Don't vote often. Just vote once, but do it early or absentee. And that pads the margins for Donald Trump in November if you're inclined to vote for him.